always keep an open mind, I think, is one thing that has really served me well. I think, in other words, open to ideas. They may not be in your core area, they may not be in your core field. Doesn't mean that they're not ideas that you can't sort of incorporate or think about in your own work or your own area. I find reasons to be optimistic every day. And again, the pace of evolution has been staggering. I mean, you just have to look back 5 years and realize how far we've come. I'm confident that we have, you know, the right kind of stakeholders, the right leaders, the right conversations are going on to make sure that this stuff is effective, it's safe, and it's available to more people than ever.
All right. So hello and welcome everyone to who's ever listening to this particular podcast. Today we have with us Dr. Matthew Lundgren. Matthew Lundgren is currently the Chief Medical Information Officer at Nuance Communications, a Microsoft company, and also holds part-time appointments with University of California, San Francisco, and as an associate clinical professor, and also as an adjunct faculty at Stanford and Duke. Few people might recognize him from his Coursera course on fundamentals of machine learning in healthcare. He's a radiologist by training and has led and contributed to multiple projects that use AI and deep learning for medical imaging and precision medicine. You can find him on Twitter at Matt Lundgren MD and also at LinkedIn at Matt Lundgren MD. So Dr. Lundgren, it's finally nice to have you again on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Thanks, Jay.
So yeah, as we were discussing, like a lot has changed since I had, I think 2 years back on the show. So you recently took the role as a Chief Medical Information Officer at Nuance Communications. Like, can you tell me what exactly does that role entail and what does that role stand in the industry as a person who is coming from a medical background?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I joined this role about 7-8 months ago. But I had, as you may recall, I had done a sabbatical with Microsoft while I was still a professor at Stanford. So it was definitely as familiar territory for me. My role is actually it's super fun. So basically, what I tend to do most of the time is I sit in this sort of strategy part of the organization in this leadership team, and in my role, I'm sort of working across the organizations. So all the way from Microsoft core research to product and core cloud services, all the way to the Nuance first party solutions, which of course, as you may know, have a fairly significant footprint, particularly in the US healthcare market.
Yeah, I see. And what kind of projects like do you currently involve yourselves? Like, are there any specific that you can talk about? Like, what exactly do they look like? And what does your role fit in over there?
Yeah, I mean, primarily, as we're starting to see more and more of these FDA-cleared solutions come out, and then, of course, there's you know, hundreds of research papers and advancements kind of going on in the academic space. What I'm really focused on, or at least the purpose of, and what I'm most excited about, I think, is really just to say, well, you know, in my time in academics, certainly continuing to see this, which is there's a development to deployment gap. I don't think it's a surprise anyone who listens to this podcast would understand that, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of models that we're building in various academic communities, even in industry, but then actually trying to get those into the hands of clinicians in a real world workflow, whether it's just to generate real world evidence or actually to have them be used clinically, that's painful. It's a difficult thing to solve. And so, you know, one of the really, really cool advantages of both my role, but then just having these organizations working together in the way that they are, is that it sort of becomes that bridge for the development to deployment gap, both for, you know, things that we're working on, but then also for our customers, whether they be, you know, startups or medium to large size companies. And then, of course, providing that tool set to academicians who are building things and want to say, hey, well, it's working great in my test environment. You know, how is this going to work in real clinical data, in a real clinical environment? And I think that gap actually is one of the most challenging to solve, because it's not just about, you know, core fundamental science or, you know, how well your model generalizes, but it's actually about the nuts and bolts and the infrastructure related to actually getting a model to provide inference on real patient data. I'm hoping by, you know, whatever contributions I'm making, in addition to the hundreds of people sort of working together on this, that we can see a faster, you know, build to deploy cycle, and then eventually have that real world evidence and feedback come back into the system, and we can get closer to that continuous learning space that we all want to be a part of in the future.
Yeah, this is interesting. And like a follow-up question to that is, like, most of the times, like, since before your stint at Microsoft, you did have a fair share of experience working in academia. And I still believe, I think you are involved. So how do these differences, like, do you see a difference between how these research projects are initiated? Like, in academic, I think it's like a much more fundamental question that we want to answer. And like we develop or we innovate stuff, or maybe we explore stuff just to answer that question, and that's where it ends. Or maybe at the best case, we have a publication, and we most of the time stop over there. But versus, how do these research work? Are they always tied to like a product they have in mind that they want to ship, or like how do the exploration weightage go over there in industry?
Yeah, it is different. I mean, you're right. I mean, there's some things that are the same, right? Which is like, if you're a good academician or you've had a successful career, you've become good at looking for what's next, right? And asking the right questions, and then designing, you know, an experiment or designing a team that can help address those questions. I think that those things are the same. But your point is taken well, which is that, you know, we are obviously in industry thinking about, you know, who's going to use this, will it scale appropriately, right? What are the other partner ecosystems that may be affected by this, either positively or potentially negatively? And then how is this driving, you know, sort of the core objectives of the business? These are things that we don't often think about a lot, right, in the academic space. So while, you know, I spent a lot of my time, you know, building up a lab, building up a program in academics, you know, writing grants, successfully sort of, you know, putting these resources together, it still is a different, I think, perspective that I'm having to bring. And one of the reasons why I'm so excited to kind of learn as part of this ecosystem is, you know, how can we actually enable the most possible people to achieve the kinds of things that, you know, we were successfully doing maybe back at Stanford or other labs are doing. And if we can achieve that, we've seen this, and I may have talked about this last time I was on with you, you know, the power of the crowd, the wisdom of the crowd, right? The ability for, you know, folks that have data science backgrounds but maybe don't have access to data, or have data and ideas but don't have access to the tools that they need to really explore their ideas. So, you know, to me, that's really the key fundamental difference. I'm thinking more about now, how can the most possible people benefit from the things that we're building, and almost kind of becoming an enabler, and no longer sort of, it has to be my idea, it has to be my solution or product. That's not the goal anymore. It's really, okay, we can see what's coming around the corner. That's the same. But then how can we prepare, you know, an infrastructure, a suite of services and solutions that can help others, you know, make it around that corner and advance into the sort of next thing. And that's what we want to do here.
Yeah, this is interesting. Then let me ask you this question. I think in the last one, we were talking more about like how exactly can AI fit into the medical industry. But right now, in the past 2 years, I think there's a fair amount of work, at least in terms of taking this thing into a real world scenario. Like, there has been lots of startups, lots of efforts from big companies that have been going into this particular domain. Do you think, like in 2022, do you think AI is kind of ready for like a prime time use in the industry, or in like in real world scenarios where it is interacting or maybe being used by people who do not have a fair background of medical, AI understandings of working? Do you think it is still ready, or at least are we on the pathway to that over there?
EJ, I fundamentally believe in the technology. I've been a part of literally hundreds of these projects. I think folks have seen, you know, work in their own areas or their own labs and things, and certainly in the startup space, we've seen products that can do things that are going to provide a significant advantage for healthcare broadly. But there's still two bottlenecks, you know, to sort of see what we know is possible to getting that into the hands of clinicians. And again, part of that's infrastructure, which we sort of discussed a little bit, which is how do we bridge that gap for the most possible people and make it as easy and safe as possible to do that. The other piece of though is at least in the US and certainly in some other countries is regulatory, right? So if you're a startup and you've got a really amazing comprehensive solution for, let's just use the example for a chest X-ray, we've seen results of these solutions not only helping clinicians make better decisions, make less mistakes, potentially get patients care faster, et cetera. But because of sort of the regulatory framework that's sort of been put together, we're still kind of treating these things as software, which have a couple disadvantages. One of them, of course, is that we don't have the ability to really use what is essentially a stochastic technology. We're kind of forcing it into a software box, right, to make it sort of fit. And the other piece, of course, is that there's this 510K approval process that we've seen, obviously, many startups kind of go. I think there's more than 300 now just in the medical imaging space. But a lot of that is very limited in terms of what they're able to do in a clinical practice. So even if I have a comprehensive solution, let's say that can do, dozens and dozens of findings and comprehensively look at a given image, taking that through regulatory in the current environment is going to take many years, right? Because you can only submit so many findings for approval. And each of those may be only used in practice for triaging things, which obviously is fundamentally less helpful than the things it can potentially do. And so I think we're still kind of figuring this out. It's obviously we're working through a conservative, kind of regulatory environment at the same time as we're wrestling with how to actually get these things deployed. And so both of those things, I think, are why we're seeing this gap. I like to think that, we were just at the RSNA, a month or so ago, which is obviously the largest radiology conference. Hundreds of vendors were there with some pretty amazing solutions. But at the same time, what they can actually be used for in practice, huge difference than compared to the NeurIPS conference, which was happening around the same time. And we saw oh my gosh, these same kinds of technologies that these companies are capable of building can do so much more. How do we line those things up so that the gap isn't so large between what we know is possible and what we're currently seeing?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned about the regulations thing that you mentioned about the countries. And I was at the MCI in September, and they mentioned they have a very AI in healthcare space debate. And I'm forgetting who was speaking in those debates, but I think there were two people. One of the guys was leading multiple startups in China, and they actually showcased the use case scenarios where they have multiple startups that are purely based on AI tools, and they are able to clinicians or any kind of experts, medical experts, can actually use these tools and reach to very remote places where they physically cannot travel. And versus, I think there was a debate point that was concerning is compared to China, the other countries like US and UK have very strong regulations in these kind of spaces. So the debate point exactly was what you said, do we need to lease up these kind of regulations in order to allow these things versus the concern that these regulations already handled. So do you think do we need to loosen up on a little bit on the regulations, or are they fairly in place but we need to focus more on a very strong validation framework for these AI tools to be passing these regulations?
I think the answer is probably both, right? I think everyone's learning together. Remember, this field is, what is it, five years old, really? Maybe 5 or 6 years old, just in terms of the application of some of these things in practice. I do agree that, rather than sort of loosening, I think it needs to evolve is probably the word I'd use. And I expect that to continue to happen. I think we're already seeing evolution. The FDA has done a phenomenal job in sort of working with community leaders and key opinion leaders and others to try to figure out exactly how do we do this in the safest possible way so that patients can reap the benefits without having to be exposed to additional risks. I think that's of course the right mentality to take to it. However, what I would wonder is whether that single governing body is sufficient to sort of allow this ecosystem to move at the pace it probably could. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of different folks with different takes on this. You know, I've heard some suggestions, which I've liked in panels, probably similar to the panel you were talking about, where you know, folks have suggested, is there not a mechanism by which we could, you know, identify centers of excellence around medical imaging AI, so they have a multidisciplinary team that have the capabilities to both build and deploy and evaluate and safely monitor. Would there not be a designation for some of those groups to be able to move a little bit further ahead without having to, you know, kind of go back through what is now really a bottleneck in terms of getting approval, both in terms of personnel and resources, right, on the part of the FDA, but then just on the part of, you know, how can they keep track of all of these things kind of going on all over the place without some other sort of surrogate approach? Again, I've heard of like having, you know, some of the societies form as honest brokers. A lot of different ideas are being thrown around, but the idea, of course, is that what is the framework that we ultimately need to agree upon where we can, you know, sort of take things into practice, again, hopefully with an infrastructure that allows us to, you know, safely deploy and monitor, and then, you know, feel comfortable with periodic audits or a periodic sort of, you know, monitoring to allow us to say, hey, this is still safe, or this is okay now. We've identified potentially a model maybe that's experiencing drift or not working as well as you know, initially intended. Can we retrain that now? And then what are the steps for that? And I think that's where we're going to need to be. You know, as I mentioned, these technologies, when used in other areas, you know, they can continuously learn and particularly be well suited to sort of get towards that precision medicine kind of concept where there's a certain population that this model is incredibly well suited for. So, you know, long story short, I think that I agree with the conservative approach 100%. As a patient, I want to make sure that anything that's being used to, you know, take part in my healthcare is, you know, is meeting a very high bar. At the same time, again, I think we could all agree that there's opportunities for this technology to do more, and we just need to figure out the best way to do that.
Yeah. And one other question is, like, do these, like, I think there's also a hype or maybe like a buzzword around these terms, like interpretability, explainability, or like a transparency of these models. And I was recently helping my professor write like the new NIH R01 grant, and we did discuss about these things. And like, how much do you think is this like fitting into the framework that you are saying, redeploy or like retrain the models and go back in an iterative process? Do you think these are like an important building blocks into that process, or is it just more like a very nice thing to have? Like, it's not a very necessary thing, but it's like, just okay, if the model is explainable, I would appreciate that. But is, or do you think this is like a many like it's like a, I would say like an important milestone into that framework?
Yeah, explainability is a tricky one. I think it almost always the answer is going to be it depends, I think, right? Because, you know, at some level, some of the models, you know, maybe in practice, not every clinician is going to say, okay, I need to see exactly why this decision was made. But at the same time, I think in the experimental phase, having some aspect of explainability built into, you know, the sort of the model engineering process is important. It's to me, it's tricky. I think ultimately, at least, you know, sort of the consensus seems to be moving a little bit away from our initial feeling, which was that everything needs to be explainable. We've also found, in a lot of our work and work from others, you know, that some of the techniques, some of the, at least in computer vision, the pixel based attribution techniques that we've been relying on, like GradCam and things, they may not be good enough, so to speak, right? At least in some of the shortcut learning type of approaches that a lot of models are trained with, right? That may change a little bit as folks are starting to move closer to, on the one hand, very carefully segmented, you know, models where, you know, there's at least a causal relationship that's much more easy yeah, to sort of backtrack into and explore. But at the same time, I think, you know, folks that listen to this would be very familiar with the sort of large language models and all the buzz that's starting to really build very quickly around them. In fact, just read a paper today by the Google DeepMind group that have sort of worked with their large language model, Palm, to sort of start to do Q&A in the medical space, right? So we are getting to a place, and the reason I bring that up now is that in the context of explainability, I can't think of a more difficult model to probe for explainability than a large language model, right? I don't think we fundamentally sorted that out. And I think at some level, if we can provide, you know, a sort of a wrapper around some of these models where they're able to give citations and you know, convince us in the medical community, particularly around medical advice or guidance, that this is coming from an evidence-based source, or this is searched the PubMed literature, or this is coming from a reputable place. I think that would be the explainability level that we would expect, rather than saying, you know, how exactly, which parameters, which data, right, was this sort of drawn from in order to sort of hold that up as the explainable necessity, right, for every single decision. It's a tough one. So I can almost see, I'm seeing two different branches really kind of starting to form. But at the same time, as a clinician, if I can trust that the model is seeing the data it's supposed to see, meaning there hasn't been any significant drift, and I have an infrastructure in place to assure that, or that it'll at least give me a heads up if it's a then I feel like I don't necessarily need to click and look for every pixel that, you know, the model made a decision on. I would have some more trust with that, as long as I had, again, that sort of you know, infrastructure to say this model is seeing what it's expecting to see. Maybe there's a monitor for the confidence. Maybe there's a monitor for the data, etc. But you know, we've looked at a lot of these things, and I feel like we're close. We're close to having that place where, again, I don't need to do a grad camp for every image that I'm looking at an AI decision on.
I see. But yeah, this is something like I also had like a very hard time wrapping around my head, because like I think I want to make like this part of my thesis also, as in, can I propose a solution that is not strictly like coming from a computer science, but as in like, because I work with people who have background in Alzheimer's and post-traumatic headache. So like, can I devise some kind of framework that can make a framework that can explain the models that I've already built? I'm not innovating anything over there, but as in like a framework that can help medical experts interact with something, what you said, like the model might be giving citations to a few things, but I still get myself confused about like, how do I approach this apart from GradCam in terms of strictly medical imaging? Because at the end, the model is trying to do like some kind of classification or regression, which has like a very univariate or multivariate output. How do I relate it back to my input, which was the only thing the model saw, that was like an image? So yeah, it's something very interesting. I don't know, but something what you said is maybe making more sense. Some kind of domain level language. Like I think one of the other speakers that I had previous to you was working on symbolic AI, and something that he suggested was something very interesting. I mean, it's very hard to do, but like having some kind of symbolic way of representing language, and then the model is trying to talk back to medical experts. Maybe that might be a way forward, but again, the dictionary is very limited.
We've done some, you know, I've seen some work in sort of, you know, breaking down sort of the free text kind of aspect, at least of what we do in our world, right? We have in theory, we have an image prompt and we create a free text sort of caption, if you want to look at it that way. And can we take the sort of the decisions by the models? There's obviously large efforts by, you know, big societies like RCNA and ACR to work together on, you know, clinical data elements, right? Where you know, the we at least have a common language for the output of the models. That's one, you know, way to sort of make that more structured. The other is to your point, can we use like a you know, RAD graph is one of the things we propose, but there's others to break down the relationships and then have them, you know, the joint embedding space is much more easier to sort of probe, particularly when, you know, we're using contrastive learning and other things. So yeah, I agree, you know, at some level, let's just, if we're just being reasonable, none of these solutions completely went out. At the end of the day, what I'm expecting, if I'm in the regulatory space particularly, I'm going to expect to say, give me a standardized kind of model card. You've seen the work, you know, by the folks at Duke at one point, showing like, you know, the ingredients, where it works, where it doesn't, and then maybe just a periodic report that's in some ways standardized to say, okay, well, you know, in the first quarter of last year, this model did, you know, this well, this, you know, it had some drift in confidence or whatever on this particular diagnosis. That kind of information, just at a high level, I think would make everyone feel much more comfortable that these systems, as they're working in the world, are continuing to perform the way that we expected. Would it be nice if every model we could do, you know, very point-to-point explainability? Yes, I think it would be. And I don't rule that out as being possible, but I would want that to sort of block, you know, the sort of inclusion of these models into our practices, because we can't get the explainability thing sorted out.
Yeah. Makes sense. And let me ask you one more non-obvious question. In medical research, we normally have these tendency of having very small data sets. And I know, I mean, this is a very, like, you can see the question coming, but I want to see, like, understand your perspective in the last 2 years. Do you see any methods that you think are making a way forward towards addressing this issue? Do you think, because, I mean, we have done a massive job, at least from a medical standpoint, where we have data sets to train on. We have certainly much more public data sets that people can experiment on. But, like, it's still like the institutional access is very limited. Only few people can access. Not everybody can train models and test models. Do you think any, from AI or computer science perspective, do you have any kind of techniques really stood out your attention into these things?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think we're, so again, just to set the stage, I mean, data has, of course, been a big part of my career, you know, not just the sort of solving some of the data access, but also just the quality of data, et cetera. I think, you know, at some level, there's a couple forces that are kind of coming to bear on this problem. One is, as you pointed out, there's still massive data scarcity. And I'm speaking in particular from, you know, the medical imaging space, but you could say that pretty much about all medical data, right? There's just some, if the fact that we still have hundreds of thousands of papers in the bioinformatics literature that's all being built on that cohort of, you know, 5 years from Beth Israel, which makes up the MIMIC data set, the ICU page, it's almost like they've shown repeatedly how valuable that data has been for us advancing our knowledge, and yet we still haven't been able to create a larger ecosystem, at least successfully. I think we're heading there, that has a comprehensive, you know, secure, de-identify patient data for us to learn patterns from and build new solutions for. But so there's this lockdown sort of, and obviously there's privacy there, but there's another force, I think, that's causing that, which is that I think, and increasingly rightly so, institutions are seeing that data as an asset, as a potentially something that they can, you know, benefit from financially. And that doesn't necessarily lead to folks wanting to give their data away, right, or to share it. It's not a sort of a resource that can be, you know, depleted, right? This is something that can be copied. So it's a little bit interesting that it's really just the control of the access to that data that creates this kind of, I guess, scarcity that allows there to be a sort of a monetary price attached to data. And of course, we could go into, which we won't now, the massive industry that sort of sits behind the scenes and sort of buys and sells de-identified medical data all day. However, all that being said, there are two big trends I think they're going to really help sort of loosen up the access data. One, of course, is that, you know, as the NIH and other large, you know, scientific groups and sort of organizations are saying, listen, you know, we're seeing a lot of advancement by groups that have access to data. We are seeing people get grants and then publish that, yet others aren't able to benefit from that work. Maybe there's some code out there, but they're not getting access to the data that made up, you know, that advancement. And I think, you know, as you know, I believe starting next month, this will be the first time where it will no longer just be kind of a nice to have suggestion for the 300,000 researchers that are funded by the NIH around the world. It will actually be sort of like, what is your plan? You need to have a plan for making the data available for other research. Otherwise, you know, all of our tax dollars are going into funding this research. We're seeing how cool they are. And yet we're not getting that ecosystem effect, that network effect of others being able to build on that. Even reproducibility is in question, right, in some cases. So there's a lot of reasons why this is an important effort. I think that's going to start to lead to groups saying, okay, we need to have, you know, a way to, you know, obviously safely and responsibly share medical data that was used for, you know, NIH funded and other types of advanced research. And a lot of that, of course, is going to be in the AI field. The other piece, to sort of finally sort of say, what's another good, why am I optimistic? I think that's one reason I do think folks are recognizing sharing is possible. But the other thing I think that's really going to change the game is going to be the generative technique. So, we could have talked on this podcast last time about, GANs and the pros and cons. And I was very lukewarm. A lot of great GAN research, still a little lukewarm on its ability to truly create data that was useful for clinically important models, right? I still was a little on the fence, partially about the feature space, partially, but it just wasn't quite right. Now with Stable Diffusion, obviously, which is, just an elegant, I love when things are like simple and elegant and they work incredibly well, because that's, to me, that this is a key example of that. And so the kinds of work, again, some of my former colleagues at Stanford have done some great work already with creating, synthetic data, essentially from using the Stable Diffusion technique, but on chest x-ray data, again, still fairly limited. Imagine now if you had the kind of scale of imaging and ideally image text pairs that potentially large health centers would have. Now you're talking about the opportunity, could we make data that can be sufficiently used to train a clinically useful model? Now that's something I'm pretty excited about. And I do think that if that turns out to be possible, and I don't have many reasons to believe it won't be, if not now in the near future, well, now you're talking about really creating a system where I can create, let's just say there's a vending machine almost, right? I can go in and I can say I need chest x-rays on, female patients in their 40s with, some rare thing. I could even, I could literally list out the things that I would want to use. And that can be for, augmentation techniques, right? For models that are failing on maybe some subcategories in their overall performance, or it could be used to just train more robust models in general. So I'm incredibly bullish on it. And I think that if for the first time in a long time, I don't have to feel like I'm, running around, with my soapbox saying, hey, we should be sharing more data. Maybe we can create the data. And if we can create, again, this comes back to infrastructure and sort of resources. But if we can create an environment where this is something that the community can use, I don't see any reason why the forces aren't aligning for this to be the next opportunity to get data in the hands of people who can build models.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like a heads up to the second point that you mentioned was using diffusion models to create synthetic data. A drawback, like I think we recently saw. So we had one paper that was using a GAN-based approach for anomaly detection. So we have like the model is trained on healthy patients and anomalous patients comes in and you can identify. And it can also localize as in which regions it can do. And the reason we developed that model was because we were working with migraine, and migraine is a very heterogeneous problem set itself. Like people with the same set of severity in migraine can have totally different looking MRI scans. So like from a data perspective. So what we realized was like, can we use diffusion model? And we have like a very small data set. You can imagine like we just have 50 patients, which I mean, from the medical standpoints of collaborators, they feel like that's a great number. But for us, like when we have to train model, that's like, I mean, those are peanuts. But I mean, I don't want to undermine, like they did tremendous work to getting those patients enrolled and everything. But when we tried our GAN-based approach, we replaced the whole framework with diffusion models. And the problem set was when we were generating models from the diseased space or the anomalous space, they were massively wrong from a medical standpoint. Mm-hmm. As in, like when we showed it, like we created the whole everything, synthetic data in a perfectly visible format. And when we showed it, the lesions or the kind of anomalies that they were trying to see, they were completely off the marks. And that was something like, I mean, we were trying to like publish these as like a very, like a limitation of diffusion models or something. But again, we are very conservative because we use a very small data set. So it's very hard to report like a very like benchmark results. But that was something very new to us. And also on the first point, I think I do agree with what you said, as in like there's a tendency that we need to make public data sets, available publicly. When I joined, I think my PhD program, one of the points was like as a computer science student, like I already had the dream of like hosting a workshop or like a challenge, like a lot of people do that. And when I had these data sets, I asked my professor, can I do this? And she was like, okay, go ahead, like you can try that. And the kind of turmoil I had, like dealing with people, getting these data sets into like a challenge at Mikai or any kind of medical, I just gave up. After 1 year, I was like, okay, I'm just going to focus on my research and just maybe try to do it. Because I do agree, like there are lots of individual private groups or labs that do like can benefit from these. Like you have seen like at Mikai over the last 3 or 4 years, like NVIDIA and lots of companies come up with so many great models just for that data set. And that's amazing. But yeah, it's like a chaos, at least from a student perspective. It's hard to do that.
I mean, kudos to you for trying. And yeah, it shouldn't be this hard. I mean, ultimately, it shouldn't be this hard. I yeah. recognize the importance of, you know, all the factors that go into it, but it shouldn't, especially from the research perspective. Again, you know, we've really tried to hit home the idea that if the data can be used for, you know, research and education purposes, that tends to be really, it fits nicely into that public good argument. Again, that we say, if everyone would benefit from this data being made available, again, in a responsible way, which we've shown we can do, then I think that outweighs any of the other, you know, mitigating factors that concern some folks. But it's all about comfort. I think I've seen, at least over the last 2 years, to your point, a lot of folks hitting their head against that wall. But even despite the fact that you don't feel like you were successful, I actually think that just by having that conversation has started the progress in your institute. And I think that's what you're seeing in a lot of places. And it just, yeah. someone will eventually get there, but because of, you know, you kind of introducing the concept, maybe one of the first people to do so at your place, I think the next few people will have an easier time. And I'm hoping that's continuing to be the case. You know, we host all these challenges, RSNA, obviously the Mikai ones are great. There's, you know, many others who are, you know, putting together medical challenges. And I think, you know, that's one way to sort of get folks rallied and really show the crowdsourcing ability. What we haven't shown, and I'd like to do this, and this is something that we're thinking about for our, at least as you know, my role at the RSNA for our challenges, is that now could we take the top models? Because everyone just says, these are overfitting challenges, right? We're not actually creating something that can be very valid in a clinical environment because we've just overfit to the task. I think that's a fair argument and it's probably true. But yet, are there ways that we can sort of look at that critically? So I don't think anyone's really taken this seriously and say, let's take the top 10, you know, finalists from a medical imaging challenge and let's actually apply that to an external data set. Let's apply that to more of a generalized, maybe even as a real world data trial, and see whether is it technique based? Is there something other than just the fact that they won the challenge or maybe some other place lower that didn't overfit as much, but maybe they're more useful clinically. So I think we're going to learn a lot from this. But again, we couldn't even have this conversation if folks weren't able to make data available. And that goes back to a lot of the research, right? Like, you know, research on, you know, bias. I don't think that's fundamentally something that startups want to start probing too much, right? They're out there trying to have impact, get market, you know, share. They're not thinking, okay, well, where does my product really cause some problems? Clearly, it's important, but the research community, that's a perfect thing for the research community to tackle, right? And I think that's, again, only possible if we have a common language, meaning a common data set that we can say, hey, I took these public data sets and I showed that you can identify self-reported race, or I showed that it underperforms in, you know, young men below 20, whatever those things are. These are important conversations that we should be having in the open. And again, I think that as we get closer to a place where you know, you have the, on the one hand, you know, research organizations, funding mechanisms that say, we need you to share your data. On the other hand, you have opportunities for, again, maybe synthetic data really does have this sea change. And I expect that to happen in the next year. Maybe those forces will come together in a way that we no longer have to spend time on our podcast talking about the data scarcity problem, because it's, you know, it's starting to get, you know, trending towards maybe being solved.
Yeah. No, I love that. So I think we did talk about, so this is very interesting. I didn't expect, but I think we did talk about large language models. We also talked about diffusion GANs. And let me ask you, like, maybe the last one that has been most trending in 2022. Vision transformers. And I think that the time I reached out, I think I saw a new publication from where one of you were one of the co-authors, is using vision transformers in medical imaging space. Like from a very brief perspective, I mean, I don't expect you to understand exactly how transformers and attentions work, but do you think, like in terms of results or the benchmark results that they are trying to produce, do you think they are kind of outperforming at least in certain tasks compared to CNNs that we had like maybe a year back or 2 years back? Because the reason I ask is like even at Mekai this year and last year, there were more than like, I think 60% of the papers were exploring vision transformers, majorly for segmentation and also for classification. Do you see, or this is just maybe like a new exploratory trend?
Well, I like the transformers, not just because, okay, again, I think that the CNN versus transformer versus whatever, I think any lab could, if you were telling them, hey, show that this is better than one, you know, show one is better than the other, you can do that. I fundamentally believe that, you know, you can, a lot of these techniques for narrow use cases are probably going to end up doing this back and forth in terms of this one's better, this one's better. We go from attention is all you need to back to, you know, convolutions are all you need, whatever. But the one of the reasons I'm really, again, this ties back into what we're starting to see more broadly in the field, which is that do you truly believe that there's it's possible to create a general model, mm-hmm. or do you think we have to have 10,000 narrow models or whatever the number is? And just practically thinking, I would almost rather work on the problem that is general, because the upside is so much bigger. And of course, the challenge then is that it requires a massive amount of compute, a massive amount of data. But I like that the transformer approach, at least for me, particularly with this joint embedding, you know, sort of we've seen the work from Microsoft Research, the BioVille paper. I can actually get to a place where the joint embedding space is precise enough that this sentence corresponds to this set of pixels, and to me. That's opening a door to saying maybe we can get closer to that general model, because if it's really just understanding, as I would imagine we could sort of boil down that humans understand, those pixels mean this thing. That's the concept that I'm in my own head, embedding head. I'm saying that's what it represents to me, and I'm going to say those words. I think having that level of, you know, facility between the two modalities, and frankly other modalities, right? We can talk about language and even video. I fundamentally feel like that's the problem worth working on, particularly if you have access to the data and the compute resources to start to probe it. I also feel like practicality, at least if you're saying, what if I'm a startup, am I going to try to, I don't know if you'd try to create that general, I think you would say, okay, I'm going to take whatever technique of the day is the most effective on my data set, because I know that when it comes time for deployment, comes time for inference, I can't have just an API stuck onto some massive model. That's a harder thing for a startup to sort of really wrap their head around and really probably pull the resources together to do. So, you know, again, long way of saying, you know, I personally am most excited about multimodality, and I do feel like, again, you could use obviously convolutions to create the embeddings for the image as well, but I just like how the things tend to fit together personally from my simplistic point of view between the image and the text with a transformer approach.
Yeah, definitely. I think I completely second that, and that was one of the reasons I got interested in transformers, like not because they are outperforming CNNs or something, but there was one very nice review study that did some experiments and saying that when we use multimodal approach, like we can also use multimodal approach with CNNs, but the attention that is given to different modalities is very wrong or like not that much accurate, even though like it's a very overfitting issue. Like, yes, it can predict or it can segment everything. But when we use transformer-based models, we might be losing accuracy, but as in a way forward towards multimodality, which is very critical, at least in medical science, that has a way forward. So that is something that got really intriguing to me. Like, okay, I don't really care about accuracy or something that I'm trying to monitor, but if it helps me way forward. And when I collaborate with people from Mayo, and when we are working on these kind of very personalized problem, you know, like migraine, like which is very it's still an open problem. Like at least for other like things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, they do have like a medical strong background where they have drugs and everything. So like they exactly know what are the biomarkers, what are the underlying reasons by a certain extent. But when we use these kind of very nuanced medical problems, I think multimodal approach has a much, much more importance rather than just using single modality prognosis or diagnostic models.
Yeah, because I think part of your work is to sort of look at, like you pointed out, we don't have a lot of great biomarkers. So can we find some? And that's a little different, right? That's a little different than saying, I just want to mimic this human task, right? I need to advance, the human's understanding of this problem. And hopefully, again, you might be able, but multimodality is the way to do that, right? You have this opportunity to take advantage of, a number of dimensions that humans can't process and find that number of dimensions where, the features that you need are all in one place. And maybe that's 1,000 dimensions, I don't know. But eventually you'll get there, right? The whole idea of the kernel trick, right? You'll eventually get to a place where, whether or not it's overfitting, but that's for you to decide. But those features really do provide new knowledge if you can trace it back and make it reproducible. I love that. And, I feel like we've seen a lot of new knowledge come from incredibly feature-rich modalities that had, relatively basic sort of human workflows. One area I really am interested in is sort of the pathology. As you take in digital pathology, massive amount of features, huge image, multiple magnification. I mean, just there's so much data there. It would take a human all day just to process one, right, to do that thoroughly in the way that some of the models. And then, and in aggregate, are we getting more information that we can sort of tease out and say, actually, this corresponds to outcomes or this corresponds to response to this drug? I think that that's a really fruitful way to approach it, taking these models, not just, again, to reproduce what we do, but to tell us something new.
I love that. I think that's one of the works that I recently did, and I don't care about the accuracy of those models, but as in we published it's a very standard approach from anyone who is from a computer science background won't find that paper very interesting, because what we did was we used off the chart ResNet 18 model. But what we did was, once we have these models trained, we developed an end-to-end back-to pipeline where we use free surfer-based tools to map it back to the original ROIs of the brain. So how can we do that? And that was something. I still don't know. I see my collaborators happy with those results. So that's my indirect way of being happy. But I think that is something biomarker discovery really intrigues me, because I don't care if it's 97% or 99% accurate. So I personally would like to see much more being done into that front. But,
and I think it'll be possible too with the other area, as you were talking, I was just realizing there's this genomics aspect to it all, right? And if we were having this conversation 3 years ago, people would be like, well, sequencing a genome is expensive, and how do we? But now it's I think the newest scanners, I've just recently heard you can do a whole sequence for around $200. It's starting to come to the place where maybe everyone can be sort of sequenced as part of healthcare. And we also have a massive amount of data, right, with data storage opportunities with cloud. Are we going to get to a place where, well, now that's a space where, again, you definitely need, computer science and machine learning techniques to draw that, phenotypic to genotypic inferences and understand those relationships better. And again, a whole nother opportunity, we could also say the same about drug discovery, et cetera. So a lot of cool things are coming. But they're sort of along the lines of the way you're looking at the problem, which is what new knowledge can I bring to the table from this massive amount of data? I love it.
Yeah. True. And despite all that we discussed, because you do come from, there are only few people that I can think of who really work at the intersection where they understand both the domains very equally and nicely. But When you talk to people who are strictly from medical science, what is the sentiment that you see when you make use of AI models? Is it truly changing over the years? Is it something that I don't believe that, I'll still stick to my training science that I'm doing, which is right, but what is the sentiment? Do you see it changing? Is it completely changed in the last 3 years?
I do. I mean, I can usually gauge it by just the kind of questions that I get on these panels, at various conferences and things, right? For a couple of years at the beginning, it was is AI going to replace me? Should I not even, you know, go into this, you know, field or whatever? I mean, there's a lot, there's legitimate, just kind of a huge misunderstanding potentially. And there's a lot of hype, and that you take it at face value because you seem like smart people and they're saying this can do this, and you take it and agree with it. But I think there's been two things have happened. One, I think, is that the audience, meaning the clinicians largely, have become much more sophisticated in their understanding of the technology. Clearly, it's coming into all parts of our lives anyway. And so we're starting to see, well, yeah, you know, Siri works for this sometimes, but it also sucks sometimes too. And that's that sort of understanding. Okay, I need to learn how to work effectively with this technology. I think that's the kind of question I'm getting more often, which is that, why can't it do this better? Because that actually would provide a better ROI. And the discussions are more about, you know, these are the four or five bigger problems that I need you, meaning the community, to help solve. I don't need you to tell me that there's a pneumothorax. I need you to, you know, tell me if the whole thing's normal to a high enough degree that I can actually save some time in my practice. These are the kinds of things I think. So again, it's more bidirectional. I think the level of understanding from the clinical community about these technologies has increased quite a bit. I would also say at the same time, the tech understanding of clinical problems has increased quite a bit. So this is where it's actually a conversation we're watching happen in slow motion all the time, right? All these millions of little interactions between clinicians and technology and computer scientists, that to me is the necessary work that we're going to need to get us to that next stage. And again, this, and just from a personal perspective, you know, part of the reason I spent so much time is, you know, sort of, you know, my own lab, and then we had the big center where we're kind of bringing groups together, forming multidisciplinary teams, creating, you know, sort of larger groups and having those conversations. And then recognizing that when I did interact from, you know, my academic role, from my clinical role, with a technology only kind of a company or group, there was that gap needs to be sort of bridged as well, right? It's not just between the clinician and machine learning. It's actually between industry and academia/medicine. And that, I think, is going to be, and that's again why I made this decision to say, well, I need to learn more too. I need to learn how to see the world through the eyes of a technology company, of an academic coming into that space and saying, okay, now I understand why these things are prioritized or these things aren't. And it's been eye-opening and for me, transformational. I've certainly learned an incredible amount. And I think that knowledge, I hope, we'll go back into being able to solve some of these problems for, you know, my colleagues in healthcare and in academia.
Yeah, no, I agree that. And I think that was also one of the things that I personally, like, I mean, coming from a very student perspective, definitely not at the scale that you are. But when I joined, like, I think I definitely underlooked the idea of working with medical professionals and working on projects that are truly at the intersection of medical AI. And even still till date, like, I think the few publications that I had like a year back, still trying to understand what metrics we are optimizing for. Because, I mean, it's very completely easy to understand from a very computer science perspective. At the end, it's just maybe 2-3 metrics that we do. But when I think defining the metrics, from a real world perspective, I think that one of the other, like, I can give a quick example is when we were trying to develop these end-to-end PET modality translations, like PETs. I still have a very hard time understanding what exactly are we optimizing for, because it's not something, when we are generating new images, it's not just like some kind of structural similarity or PSNR that we are optimizing for, but it's like understanding how exactly are these PETs being used for quantification of like cognitive loads, like, because these are Alzheimer's patients. At the end, we want to make sure that we can get some kind of mental scores that we use. And that idea, like wrapping your head around, because we want to develop models that can optimize specifically for that. I don't want the brain structures to be completely synthesized. So this is something I definitely underlooked a lot. But maybe, like, I just want to probe you a little bit more, because I think you started off this role in this particular domain itself. Is, do you still think that the gap between computer science collaborating with medical researchers and the other way around is a significant one? Like, as in, like, I think one of the panels that I learned from, I forgot his name, but there was this interview with Andrew Yang, and he answered that question saying that the gap, like not any computer science or medical researcher can work at this intersection. It takes a huge amount of training to do that. So my question to you is, what kind of things would you recommend or maybe suggest people when they are working at this forefront based on your experience training a lot of people?
Yeah, it's a great question. I certainly wouldn't want to imply that, you know, it's all hand, we're all together in one, you know, we all understand each other perfectly. It's definitely still a little bit of a tower of Babel. It's not as bad, I think, as when we started because of that familiarity and probably a little bit of healthy skepticism, right, on the part of the clinical community too. And then maybe also a healthy respect for the challenges and the difficulty in healthcare by sort of the computer science and machine learning groups. But yeah, I think it, the what you're doing is exactly what I think we've seen be one of the most successful strategies coming from the computer science side of the aisle, like literally looking at the problem, following. I mean, we used to say, you know, particularly in the pre-COVID times, I had my students shadowing clinicians that were performing the tasks, were working in the environment that was related to the project, right? Seeing how the work is done, seeing the challenge, seeing and even having the clinician articulate what are they thinking, why did they say this, because it's not always obvious. And sometimes for the clinician it's not always obvious because it becomes almost a reflex. It's brainstem level knowledge now, right? We've done this for decades and our training is so intense, there's things that we just know by reflex and sometimes by instinct. And so how do we start to have that conversation? So that's one way I think that I've seen things be incredibly successful. On the other side, you know, I think the clinicians that have said, you know what, I don't need to learn, you know, Python and go through Andrew's course necessarily, but I would like to have a conversational understanding of the types of techniques that are available out there. What sorts of problems are they good for? What problems are they not good for? So that when I do have that, you know, list of ideas, because every clinician's got a list of ideas of things that they know for sure AI should and can do, that list becomes much more realistic after just a little investment on the part of the clinical side to say, okay, clearly a robotic surgeon is not necessarily going to be my first project. Can we think of something else slightly, you know, slightly more solvable that is still, you know, sort of necessary? And so, I go back to that comment I made earlier, which is that these conversations are happening in real time everywhere in the world between clinicians and machine learning, whether it's, you know, because of a company's approaching them, because, you know, they're looking to do cloud migration, or if it's literally an academic environment where, you know, machine learning researchers are reaching out and vice versa. We're all meeting each other kind of for the first time, right? We've never really had, besides sort of the field of bioinformatics, which is a very niche area, we really hadn't ever had this broader coming together of these two fields. And there's a lot of things that make us, you know, very different, right? There's the move fast, break things, and there's the first do no harm. Those are very different cultures to reconcile fundamentally. But at the end of the day, I think as we're seeing, again, in the sort of the ecosystem, the startups, the large technology companies, there's still a willingness to say, yes, we're starting to understand it's hard and it's not going to happen tomorrow, but there's still so much value and upside, and there's enough signal that we can all agree, I think, that this is still worth doing and this is still possible to achieve. And that optimism, I think, is really what carries me forward. I find reasons to be optimistic every day. And again, the pace of evolution has been staggering. I mean, you just have to look back 5 years and realize how far we've come, right, in such a short amount of time. I just can't even imagine what we're going to be seeing in the next decade. But I'm confident that we have, you know, the right kind of stakeholders, the right leaders, the right conversations are going on to make sure that this stuff is effective, it's safe, and it's available to more people than ever.
Yeah, yeah. And since you mentioned like every clinician has kind of a list of things AI should be able to do, like kind of a demanding thing. And since we're in the end of 2022, what are the things that I think people do make resolutions like this is something I'm very hopeful for 2023. What kind of things that you would say you are hopeful for? Or maybe like if you want to pick at least a number, let's say three things that you are really hopeful for this space of AI and medical that you want to see in 2023. What would be that three things?
This is a pretty easy one for me because, you know, of all the things that have been happening just in the last few months with, you know, with ChatGPT and the large language models and things that we, you know, we would expect to see in the next, you know, year or so. I think that we're getting to a place where I expect, not just want, but expect that large language models are playing a role in both knowledge summarization, the ability to sort of, you know, get answers in a very intelligent conversational way, both from medical data, but also sort of, you know, literature data to help doctors make better clinical decisions. I expect to see large language models as part of the clinical decision-making process in the very near future. And I expect that to truly transform a lot of aspects of you know, sort of the day-to-day of healthcare. Again, you'd be surprised to see how challenging it can be if you ever followed a clinician around, how hard it is to find things in the chart, how hard it is to summarize things for a patient, how hard it is to have a just a meaningful conversation about this diagnosis means X, or I need to know the newest, best evidence for Y. These are difficult things. They're still, you know, very time consuming for physicians to do. And these are things, summarization and, you know, knowledge synthesis is something that these, you know, emergent behaviors that we're seeing in these large languages, they're incredibly good at doing these things. And so I, you know, putting those two things together, you know, for example, an EHR and a large language model together, what could that do for us? Or medical knowledge as a whole in a large language, what could that do for us? The possibilities are really limitless. And the best part, for me at least, is that it doesn't have to be just the things I think are cool or useful. It's actually can be whatever you think is cool and useful, right? It's every individual clinician might find a use for that, but the core fundamental technology that it's drawing from is the same. Yeah. That to me is just, you know, really why I'm so excited and optimistic about how, again, these fields coming together. None of this would have ever happened had we not started a conversation, you know, whatever it was years ago. And now we're starting to get to a place where the things that we're looking at, right, the probing that we do of these large language models isn't just based on logic or isn't just based on a Turing test or whatever, an IQ test. It's based on, now we're looking at what are the medical capabilities, right? This is so cool to see that this is actually an active area of research really advancing forward, again, independent of any specific narrow use case. I'm incredibly excited.
Yeah, definitely. That makes two of us, definitely. So, yeah. And one last question before I sign you off is, any tips for young researchers? Because most of the audience that listens to this podcast are like people, like PhD students or people from medical background. Do you have any tips for those kind of people who are specifically, I mean, it's like, if we want to keep it open, we can keep it open to both the fields. But even if people who are working at the intersection, what kind of tips would you give them for their career? As in, how, what are the pitfalls that you would tell them to definitely avoid and things to look forward as the field progresses and changes every day?
That's a great question. I guess I do have enough gray hair to give some advice now. I think in generally, always keep an open mind, I think is one thing that has really served me well. I think, in other words, open to ideas. They may not be in your core area. They may not be in your core field. Doesn't mean that they're not ideas that you can't sort of incorporate or think about in your own work or your own area. I think that's one. And then that extends, in my mind, to careers. I think folks get really worked up about, do I do academics? Do I do industry? You know, do I start my own company? As if those are all mutually exclusive options. And I think it's important to just, again, talk to older folks, older than me even, if you want, but recognizing that when you look back at the end of your career, just like you would at the end of your life, what are the things that you'd regret the most? And probably some of those things would be not taking a chance to do X, Y, Z, or thinking that you didn't have that option to do that. And I would argue that you always have the opportunity with the skill sets that you're developing as part of your PhD program, or maybe you're in medical school. That knowledge is flexible and usable in a variety of places. You just need to find things that interest you, that you know are so excited about that you wake up thinking about it. And if that happens to be happening maybe in academia, then that's great. If it's happening in industry, that helps make that decision for you. I don't know if that's helpful to those of you out there listening, but But really, I found myself when I was, you know, just not even 10 years ago thinking, okay, this is the tract and this is it. This is a 30 to 40 year career. And this is what I'll be doing forever. And I guess the idea that, you know, these fields are coming together in ways that haven't ever, you know, has never happened before, also means that all of you out there have that same opportunity for flexibility in your career. And I encourage you to take advantage of it. There's nothing more fun than taking knowledge that you've learned from one domain and seeing how it fits in another domain. And oftentimes you find that not only does it fit, but it also could potentially advance that new area in ways that you never thought of before. So that's probably my best advice.
Yeah, no, definitely makes sense. And I think it's very fitful to your portfolio because you have like a very diverse set of portfolio of collaborations coming from a medical background and working at place that really creates an impact. So definitely, I think that advice completely makes sense. And yeah, hopefully people do that in their respective fields where they are trying to merge knowledge from two different fields and creating something really unique. So yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for that. But yeah, apart from that, I think we are at the end of the podcast. So yeah, I'll just like to thank you once again. I think thanks for being on the show at such a fun time of the year. So definitely it's very hard to get people at this time, but appreciate you for being on the show and hopefully I can have you once more on the show. So yeah.
Thanks again, Jay. It's always a pleasure. Always great seeing how your work has progressed. And I look forward to seeing what you're doing in the future too. Thanks again.